Welcome back. This week, we continue with Dr. Colin DeYoung, a personality neuroscience researcher and associate professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota. This is a continuation of our discussion last time where we discussed the hierarchical taxonomy of psychopathology as an alternative or a direction for DSM and ICD diagnostic systems to move towards. I recommend you listen to that too, and I hope you enjoy the discussion today. So your cybernetic theory or Big Five cybernetic theory and cybernetic theory of psychopathology, they take this high top idea a bit further, right? So what?
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit?
So, of course, yes. And so these ideas are not officially, aligned with high top. They're not part of the consortium, but they are, my own development. Of a scientific understanding that is certainly based around this idea of a dimensional model of psychopathology. And also really around the empirical recognition that the dimensions of psychopathology that we've been talking about, like these different spectra, are very closely aligned with dimensions of personality variation that we know from the study of normal personality over the last 50 or 60 years. And I think a good segue would be to say that, if we have high top as a good way for conceptualizing cases, and that seems already to be pretty clear. And in fact, it can be used in conjunction with the current system, right? So they're already, as you said, people use things like the Beck depression inventory, people use these dimensional models to help them even in the context of the existing system. And high top can already be used in that way. But let's imagine that someday it actually comes to replace the system. Then we have to say, well, when do you get an official diagnosis of mental disorder? And there are maybe like two different ways that the consortium is thinking about and it is working on and it is and researching. One would be to say that for any one of these symptom dimensions, like the internalizing dimension or a lower level anxiety dimension or whatever it is, there's some cutoff, just like the way we use for the Beck depression inventory. And if you get over that cutoff, then we're going to say, okay, now you have an anxiety disorder, and now you have an internalizing disorder. And we said that's the onset of mental illness. But I think there's a serious problem with that approach to diagnosis. And there is another alternative, which is that rather than just focusing on these different features and symptoms that people have, that you focus on people's dysfunction, their impairment, their levels of distress, their inability to meet their basic needs or to pursue their life goals. And you really say that, and in fact, I should point out, you already see this in some of the DSM diagnoses, in which there's not only a set of symptoms that you need to be manifesting, but then you also have to show evidence of sufficient, what they call clinically significant distress or impairment. Now, one of the problems with the DSM is all this is underspecified. It just essentially leaves it up to the clinician's judgment. So nowhere in the DSM does it define impairment or dysfunction. It just essentially leaves that up to the clinician's sense of, tradition or what intuition or whatever about what is clinically significant. And so I think that we can actually take that and make that more centrally part of the way in which we understand psychopathology and ultimately the way in which we diagnose it. It's based in a theoretical perspective that's known as cybernetics. It's also known as control theory. And it's basically about the principles that govern goal-directed systems. And those could be, organisms are the main thing that we know of that are goal-directed systems. But it actually, this perspective emerged way back in the 1940s and 1950s as people started to create more and more sophisticated artificial control systems for things like, anti-aircraft guns in the Second World War that could automatically, to some extent, track a trajectory and so that they could fire more accurately. And then, of course, the development of the early computers and things like a computer that can play chess, right? You're creating artificial systems that are trying to pursue a particular goal, and they're doing that based on feedback in terms of their actions and then feedback from the results of those actions. And so it was Norbert Wiener was a brilliant scientist and mathematician who first had this insight about the necessary parallels between artificial and natural control systems and started to try to formulate some of these principles, both conceptually and mathematically. And then that goes on to become incredibly influential, both in computing, right? You know, cybernet, we have words like cyberspace and cybersecurity, right? That all comes from cybernetics and from that initial observation and theoretical development. But then also in cognitive science and attempting to understand the principles that the brain is using basically to initiate action and to guide its perception of the world. So, you know, there's, if we go back to kind of classic behaviorism, there's this picture of the organism as a passive reactor to things in the environment, right? There's a stimulus and then there's a response. And the naive perspective on this is that the stimulus is something objective and external, and the response is created by the organism as a reaction to the stimulus. But that's not what organisms are like at all. In fact, organisms are spontaneously active and spontaneously perceiving. And perception itself is actually an active process of gathering information and constructing models of the world. So there's all this spontaneous activity that needs to be explained. And that's what evolution does, is that it builds systems that are goal-directed, that pursue goals that actually facilitate survival and reproduction. And that's what drives evolution. That's why the systems continue to exist, because they are active in pursuing their own continuation and their own reproduction. So there's this whole sort of set of abstract principles that are really, I think, the basis of any effective understanding of biological systems. And we can use that to understand basically how humans work. And then we can understand personality as especially these broad personality traits like extroversion and negative emotionality and conscientiousness, these things that we talk about in personality psychology. We can understand those as essentially settings in these underlying cybernetic mechanisms that everyone has, because everyone has a human brain, right? And so the brain has all these mechanisms that allow us to pursue our goals effectively. And so negative emotion, for example, is a reaction to the detection of an error. We're trying to do something, we expect something, it doesn't go the way we planned, or there's a signal that we might not be in the situation we want to be in, or that the situation might have some threat to our basic goals, our basic needs. That triggers negative emotion. That's a key element of that whole feedback process by which a goal-directed system attempts to pursue the things that it wants and avoid the things that it doesn't want and avoid the things that will interfere with its pursuit of its goals. So we can see personality as basically a reflection of just the different tunings, and there's a normal range of personalities. These systems have there's no single right answer for what's the sensitivity of the threat system, what's the sensitivity of the reward system, how tight should the control on motivation relative to long-term versus short-term goals be. There's no single right answer, right? Because circumstances are different, individual lives are different, different ecological niches. So we have we maintain this broad variety of personalities. Then we can also see mental illness and psychological dysfunction as instances in which the system is no longer able to pursue its goals effectively. And when I say goals, I mean that very broadly, to include things like, you know, people's very basic needs as well as more specific goals that they might have. And so I think that fundamentally, when we talk about mental illness, what we were talking about are instances in which people's ability to pursue their important goals in life breaks down, and then they're not able to adapt and develop new goals or new strategies to pursue their goals or new interpretations of the world that would allow them to bring that system back online. And that second part is really important, because it's not just that we can't just say that somebody's mentally ill when they can no longer pursue their goals effectively, because of course everyone has disaster happens in their life once in a while and things go wrong, or you're planning something and it just doesn't work out. That doesn't make you mentally ill. What makes people mentally ill is when they encounter those kinds of difficulties, those kinds of vicissitudes, and then they are incapable of adapting and getting back on track. when they are stuck in this kind of dysfunctional loop, and maybe it even feeds into itself, so it makes it worse and worse, and they can't adjust their goals or adjust their strategies to get back into a mode of functioning. And so if you look at the way that the DSM proceeds, or the way that people's just sort of popular thinking about mental illness is, we tend to think of it the other way around, that there is something odd about you, like you have these weird features, like you tend to have, you know, weird, you hear voices and you have certain delusions about that. And that means that you're a particular category of person. You're a schizophrenic, say, in this case. And then we think, well, of course, it's because you're a schizophrenic that you have mental illness, right? That you're dysfunctional. That is your mental illness, in fact, is the schizophrenia. And then that leads you to not be able to do what you want and need to do in life. So we take that perspective, that it's the kind of unusual ways of functioning that are the mental illness, and that those then produce dysfunction. But I think it's actually the other way around, in which people have certain kinds of peculiarities, which are really just features of their personality, especially if they're persistent, and many features of mental illness do tend to be persistent over many years. And it's those peculiarities that then put us at higher risk for dysfunction. But it's the dysfunction itself, this inability to meet our needs and pursue our goals, that we should be focusing on diagnostically as the hallmark of mental illness. Right? And so I would turn kind of the diagnostic process on its head, so that in the DSM, you know, you look for the right symptoms, and then kind of as a last thing, you say, okay, is there sufficient impairment or distress? You know, you have to meet that box as well. I would start with the impairment and distress and say, okay, is this person able to function? And actually, once again, you know, I think maybe this is just bias on my part, but I think this is more like what clinicians actually do. Someone comes into the clinic because they are suffering or having some kind of a problem. And the clinician starts by trying to understand what is their problem? What are the concrete dimensions of what is going wrong in their lives? And so that is the most important thing. And then from there, in order to conceptualize the case, then you move out to, well, what are the kind of typical patterns that this person has, and what are the features of their personality? And if they can't get along with other people, is it because they're having some kind of paranoid ideation, right? But let's, you know, we probably all have known people who seem to be perfectly normal functioning, but seemed a bit paranoid, right? You know, that's just a dimension of personality that people vary on. Some people are a little bit more paranoid than others. And so from my perspective, it's not until that paranoia actually interferes with important things in that person's life functioning that we should be thinking about mental illness. And even then, we don't say that that person now, like, okay, now you're a paranoid schizophrenic. No, that's not the way that we approach the situation, even if they meet the diagnostic criteria in the traditional system. Instead, we say, well, what are your specific pattern of symptoms? And there we use something like HITOP to profile not just, you know, not just the paranoia, which would be one specific dimension, but we want to see what the range of their characteristics are like. You know, and when we realize that these categories of symptoms are also categories of personality, then we can see how this all becomes a more natural way to look at people's problems in terms of how do your typical patterns of functioning and behavior lead to risk for dysfunction, for being unable to get what you want and need in life effectively, right? And then, you know, there are going to be various treatments that are appropriate based on the larger pattern and based on the specific things that are causing problems. And what we're trying to do ultimately is get people into a place where they have the right kind of strategies that they need to be able to pursue goals effectively and to get what they need in life. And that may look very different for different people, right? One of the examples that I really like, should I do an example?
Go ahead. Yes. I think they'll help.
Yeah. So there's this study that I love because it's such a perfect illustration of this, because we often think of, you know, hallucinations and delusions as, you know, those are psychotic symptoms. They're extremely severe. We think of those as associated with the most severe forms of mental illness. But there's increasingly lots of evidence that normal people, normal personality variation, people have things that would count as hallucinations. They hear voices. It's not unusual at all. You know, people have delusions. They think, well, you know, they believe in fate, or, you know, the gambler's fallacy, or whatever, or astrology, right? There are all kinds of delusions that people have. I'm sure there are delusions that I have that I wouldn't even recognize as delusions, right? And so there's just much more continuity between normal personality variation and psychopathology than the psychiatric establishment and I think the popular imagination typically recognizes. Okay, so there's this study and they focus on a group of people who work as psychics. Okay, and the way that they define this operationally is these are people who have auditory hallucinations. They hear voices at least once a day, and they're getting communications from what they call other realms. So this could be from the spirit world, from, you know, beyond the grave, whatever it is. These are people who hear voices and believe that they are speaking to, you know, spirits, dead people, whatever. So from the perspective of the DSM, this is clearly, this is psychosis, right? So they meet these symptom criteria. They have hallucinations and delusions, but they're considered healthy. And why are they healthy? Well, they don't have obvious impairment. They're not distressed. They're fine with being psychic. You know, some of them are maybe working as psychics and therefore allowing other people to communicate with these other realms. They have friends. They have normal social networks. And the study compared a group of those people to a group of psychotic patients who also had daily auditory hallucinations. What they found was that in terms of all the standard measures of symptoms, when we looked at those hallucinations that are, and that's the core feature of schizophrenia, for example, you can't get a diagnosis of schizophrenia without hallucinations or delusions. And so they compare them, and on those measures of hallucination, no difference between the groups, between these, you know, healthy psychics and psychotic patients. Now, of course, if we look at other areas of symptoms, you know, things like anxiety, depression, distress, whatever, then of course, then we see differences between the patient group and the psychics. But the point is that it's not the symptoms per se that are the criteria for mental illness, even though in the DSM, we start from the symptoms. In fact, what this shows is that it is the dysfunction and the inability to meet your basic needs and pursue life goals that are the reason that we characterize someone as mentally ill versus not. And, you know, you could say, well, okay, fine. So the system's working because the psychics don't get a diagnosis. But imagine if you take one of those people and something, I don't know, you know, they experience a death of someone close to them, or you know, they lose their business, and now they're having now they're a bit anxious and depressed because things are going badly in their life. And now we take them to, and maybe they say, okay, I need some help because I'm just feeling so bad, and they go to a clinician. What happens? Well, most likely the fact that they experience daily auditory hallucinations comes up. And now they're diagnosed with schizophrenia, right? But is that their problem? And almost certainly they will be given, drugs that are designed to target psychosis. They'll be given antipsychotics. But is that what they need? They were functioning just fine with their psychotic symptoms, prior to having some, unfortunate event in their lives. But the way the current system is set up, we have to consider all of those things, and the psychotic symptoms take priority and the symptoms come first before the dysfunction. And so that's what ends up happening.
So it's really this big shift in perception of like what we of kind of putting emphasis on the distress and the lack of ability to function rather than like the specific symptoms. And I think I kind of raised my hat to you for taking the schizophrenia and delusion example, because I think that's kind of the hard case to make, because it's like where do you draw the line of something being a dysfunction in the brain, is it a dysfunction that's not causing trouble but it's still a dysfunction, or is it something that is not actually a problem and like you said on a continuum, because we know that lots of people hear voices that like not all of them are psychic, not all of them act as psychics and they're still living normal lives, and it's much more common than you'd think.
Right.
But I think when you take depression or anxiety, for example, then I think this is very much what, like, and you, somebody goes to see a psychologist or a psychotherapist, then I think this is very much what you would often see. in the case conceptualization that you see like you're talking about goals, and I like how you're I'm worried that we're not doing justice to your theory because we're having to run through it so quickly. Like it's really, it has nuance to it, like with the different levels of goals and the idea that you can have like these basic social basic needs, like social needs and needs for like self-esteem or status and whatnot. And you can see like, you can go like, so these then go into more specific goals of like needing friends and needing to not have conflict with family members and whatnot. And people can have variation in what needs are how important, what goals are how important for each person. And then if they get into this loop of not being able to move towards their goals or fulfill these needs that they have, then you start having like risk for dysfunction. And then you need to have something that you conceptualize to go like, okay, so where is this going wrong, this system? Like, how are we ending up in this distress and this dysfunction? And I think that in a case conceptualization was seeing like, what are you sustaining? Like, what are sustaining the problems that are going on? What may be behavioral patterns? What ways of thinking? What things that we've learned from our past experiences in relationships and our kind of early experiences that leave an imprint in us, that how are these affecting how we're functioning now and how it's going wrong? Then I think it's very harmonious with a kind of like both common sense perspective and what is happening in lots of psychological treatments, rather than this idea that diagnosis and then diagnosis leads to specific treatment and this treatment which kind of like follows the mold of a more traditional medical model that I'm not sure that has its strengths but also has its weaknesses when we're dealing with these issues. And I notice we're at 5:30, so you're in a, you need to move on. can I hold you for like 5 to 10 minutes more?
Yes, no, I don't actually have another another thing scheduled immediately, so I'm happy to keep talking a bit.
Okay, because this is the thing that we didn't have time to come back to yet, which was with the idea of what is etiology and what's a brain disorder. And I think that this is where I'd love to kind of hear your thoughts, because I think this is very different. The way you conceptualize this in the cybernetic theory, which is also, is it a bit like self-regulation? Like cybernetic is such a kind of like machine, yes. And what are it is. Are we talking about self-regulation, towards
self-regulation.
Goals, towards yes. certain goals? Basically, to have dysfunction, you need to get caught in some kind of loop or something that's like making it hard for you to actualize your goals, like have the relationships or have like a feeling of status in your community or your job or whatnot, and have connection with people and so on. Then, because the way you describe it, it sounds more like a maladaptive pattern that you get caught in not being able to figure things out, and that's what causes the dysfunction, and that's when we would start talking about like a mental illness at some point if you use that term. And when we talk about this brain disorders, it's a very different idea. It's like something has gone wrong in your brain on a biological level, hence you are ill, hence you have these symptoms. And hence you have these problems in your life. And I hadn't read that much of the kind of psychiatric diagnostic literature, and I was looking at it now a bit for this, and it struck me how much of it is based on this idea that these will be disorders that we will conceptualize in the same way as we conceptualize disorders of the body. They'll have an etiology, we will find the etiology, and then we will cure the etiology, and then the symptoms will go away. And then when people talk about what's going on it's just hard for me to reconcile that with this idea of what's the symptom and what's the disease. Like if we talk about, say, depression and anxiety, then these are normal states that anybody can experience. Like when they're transient, when they're adapted to the situation, there's nothing, they're healthy. But then if you get stuck in not being able to resolve them in some way and they become repetitive and cause distress and impairment, then you've got a problem that you might need help with. And on a biological level, are these not like neural activation of a network in the brain, and that the certain way of activating is the physical counterpart of what you are psychologically experiencing. That it's not that the brain is producing the symptoms, it's that these are the different sides of the same coin. That when I feel depressed and I'm having these ruminative thoughts, then a certain activation pattern is going on in my brain.
Of course.
So, like if I have a stomach bug and it's causing me to vomit and to have fever, then I have an infection, I have some pathogen in my stomach. But the actual symptoms are happening in my brain, right? If I have stomach pain, it's my brain that's registering that there's something wrong in my, like the, my stomach
there
is setting up.
But actual tissue damage in your stomach.
Right, there can be, yes, but the symptoms that I'm experiencing, like in order to recognize the tissue damage, something needs to recognize it in my brain, right?
But now we're getting into like this philosophical discussion of consciousness, right? Because yes, everything is, all of your experience is obviously produced by your brain.
Right.
But we can even just think about the self-regulation of the organism at lower levels, right? So like your immune system is recognizing that there is some damage to tissue caused by whatever this pathogen is. And it is springing into its own whole set of regulatory actions. And that's going to happen regardless of whether you are consciously aware of it, whether it becomes part of your experience. So the symptoms defined as, you know, subjective experience, of course, involve consciousness, yeah, because that's what subjectivity requires.
And a lot of the symptoms will have unconscious, like if I'm vomiting, then it's not my stomach that's vomiting. It's you know, like something in my brainstem. It's causing me to vomit. Even if I'm not cognitively deciding to vomit, then I'm sorry to take this as such a non-appetizing level, the discussion.
A problem.
but if the idea is that when you have these symptoms that you can recognize, in a body disorder, you can fix what's in the body. The body will stop sending up sense data to some extent. And yes, there will be mechanisms going on as well, maybe on a cellular and tissue level directly there. But basically you can have, like, when it corrects it, then there's no more signal going up to the brain telling you that you're feeling bad and sick and setting your thermostat in the wrong position in your brain and whatnot to have a fever. And then you have a kind of etiology in the stomach and you fix it so there are no longer symptoms. But when you look at depression or anxiety, then the very feelings and emotions that we call the symptoms are also the brain activations, like physiologically going on in your brain. So there's no, like, there doesn't need, like, sure, there can be a separate etiology, like you can have inflammation and that's causing things like, and things to go up in your brain. You can have a brain tumor and that's affecting the network. But that's not a necessity in this way of thinking about it, right? Like you can just have your brain have learned, and I don't mean this in a reductionist way of taking away from the lived experience. It's just that these two things coincide and happen at the same time. That the way your brain is responding is actually the symptom as well. That there's an activation pattern in my brain that corresponds to me feeling really bad and having these thoughts, and that it's a different way of thinking about etiology, and then what's a symptom and what's a cause. That both on a psychological level, if we say like, okay, like having childhood trauma is an antecedent, then yes, but that will have had its effects on the brain. And that will make me more likely then to get into this maladaptive pattern of not being able to reach, say, my relationship goals and fall into depressive thoughts and kind of negative emotions in those situations. So I think that the way that we talk about what is a symptom and what is the cause of the disease, then when we're talking about processes that are also natural activations in the brain that just kind of get stuck for some reason, then there seems to be a level of the discussion that there seems to be a level of confusion in the discussion that we're trying to talk about them the same way we talk about diseases usually. And I'm just not sure that that's helpful in this context where there are also natural responses that you're kind of stuck with and just causing trouble that needs to be fixed and helped in some way or another. And it can be pharmaceutical or biological or psychological to help, but this finding of the etiology seems a bit strange to me, because obviously if you have a complex neural system that has a complex way of reacting, then you're going to have multiple ways of finding states of distress and kind of like disharmony in it that you can get stuck with. What do you think about this?
Yes, I agree with. I think I share your perspective on this largely. I think that one way to think about it is that when there is some mental illness, there's symptoms, there's a problem, there's dysfunction, and you need to intervene. There are two kinds of changes that you can think about making. So first, you can change the way the person has learned to, or you can try to help the person change the way that they've learned to interpret various types of things in their lives and the various kinds of strategies that they use to respond to those things, or even maybe some of their goals are not really well integrated with each other or viable. Like you might say, well, you shouldn't be striving for this particular thing, right? You can essentially try to assume that the person's brain functions normally enough that it's not a serious problem with some basic parameter of the underlying mechanism, but rather has to do with what that brain has learned in terms of how it wants to react and how it wants to behave. And then, you know, you do something like cognitive behavioral therapy, where you try to teach the person new strategies for thinking and acting, right? And so you are saying, well, the mechanisms of the brain itself are not the problem. The problem is, you know, in a computer metaphor, the program that's running on those mechanisms. But then another thing that you might conclude is that, well, there is something so sort of dramatic and unusual about the way that this brain is operating that we might want to actually try to adjust that mechanism itself. So, for example, you know, let's say you have somebody who has who's prone to bouts of mania that are really severe and pretty intractable. You know, for that kind of person, although we don't know exactly why, we know that lithium can often be used to prevent people from having manic episodes. So, you know, I think there are these two different routes that you can take. And this is reflected in some of the details of my personality theory that we haven't really gotten into, that people's personalities can be divided into these kinds of general basic traits that reflect these parameters of underlying mechanisms that everybody has and that just function in slightly different ways in different people. Or they can be part of people's characteristic adaptations, the ways in which we've, you know, if I, you know, love like a particular type of food, for example, that might be so consistent. It's part of my personality. I identify with that, you know, whatever. But it's part of my personality, but it seems a bit different from something like my level of extroversion, right? And that's because it's something that I have learned. It's a way I've adapted to my specific life circumstances. And those two different kinds of personality feature are indicative of these two different ways that we can intervene when people have problems, right? We can say, well, what we need to do is, you know, get them to relearn their existing habits of thinking and feeling and acting and wanting. Or we can say that, well, we need to actually fiddle with the underlying mechanisms that do the learning and that do the acting, because they are so dramatic that they are just leading this person into these dysfunctional states. But I think it's still important to recognize that even if we decide the problem is something that would be best addressed, you know, like with lithium and mania, so it's about these underlying mechanisms and retuning them, that still doesn't mean that the reason the person is mentally ill has to do, should be considered a brain disease, right? This is where it gets closest to being a brain disease. But the reason that I don't like to go that far is that I think you can find somebody else who has, let's say, a similar degree of manic activation. And if we actually looked at the brain scan, we're going to see a very similar pattern. But for whatever reason, because of the niche that this other person has in their lives, they know how to deal with their own, you know, manic tendencies. Maybe they have a very good social support system. Maybe they're in a kind of job where they can actually express that, or maybe they can take them. Maybe they like to, you know, I don't know, go backpacking when they're in a manic episode and go off for a couple of weeks. Like, they're just, they could have the same level, in other words, of mania if we did some kind of symptom assessment. But whether or not they're actually mentally ill because of it actually depends on whether it causes them dysfunction or not, right? And so I feel like our typical tendency, both in medicine and in popular imagination, is to say that, well, because you have that tendency to mania, that means that you're mentally ill, and then you can either, you know, have it under control or not. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'd like to say that as long as you have it under control, which means that you are able to pursue your goals effectively and get what you need in life despite that sort of peculiarity of your personality, then you're not mentally ill.
Right.
So it makes it something that has more to do with the dysfunctional circumstances, rather than, I feel like we tend to discuss mental illness in a way that makes it almost like an inherent property of the person that's there forever. But why do we do that? With physical illness, we, of course, you're going to get sick at some time in your life. You're going to have a cold, you're going to have a flu, you're going to have COVID, you're going to have whatever. And we don't expect that somebody will always be healthy. But with mental illness, it's much more this sense that you would really, you should never be mentally ill. And once you are, oh, then that probably means that you have some permanent problem. And I really think that that is an unfortunate and sort of stigmatizing and unhelpful way that we deal with mental illness.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice thought to end on. I think it's something that to really ponder about, and how it's also a kind of value expression of how we meet people, and how we choose to look at these things, and what words we choose to use. Thank you so much for your time. I'm really grateful, and thank you for going a bit overtime with me today. This is all really exciting stuff. Looking forward to seeing how HITOP progresses and your theory and how things hopefully take flight, and I love how the normal personality research gets expressed in these theories, and we didn't have a chance to talk about the links between normal personality traits and the psychopathology and those dimensions that we have there in personality and otherwise. So it's really interesting stuff that you're working with. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a really interesting conversation. And if people are interested in learning more about my work, if you just search for my name on the internet, I have a webpage that has most of my publications available on it. So
that's right. Yeah. If you Google Colin DeYoung, you'll find lots of interesting stuff. Thank you. And I hope you have a great sabbatical in Germany. So I hope you have a great sabbatical and
great.
All right.
Thanks so much. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.